This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
One isn't allowed to paskin a shayla in front of one's rebbe. I guess that it applies even more so. Well, that's not stated in the halacha that way. That in divrei hashkofa, when one's talking about even more delicate areas, such as matters of hashkofa, one there too the din would apply that one would not be permitted to say anything in front of one's rebbe without his permission. So I shall start off by asking the reshus of my father, who we're very happy to have with us, as I mentioned earlier, to those of you who were here, and who I have managed to persuade to give this year next Motzei Shabbos. So you're in for a treat, and so am I, and for a break, and we all look forward to it very much. I'm going to talk to you about something a little bit difficult, I think. Some of the things I'm going to bring you we've actually learnt before. There's a Rashi I'm going to learn with you that we've learnt before. There's a piece of Vilna Gaon that I'm going to learn with you that we've learnt before. But there's a new angle to it, where there's a Yesod, where there's a principle on which a lot of things are based. And they're things which actually have practical application in a person's life, and I think which one needs to understand. In the process of doing that, we're going to throw another aspect of clarity on two issues which again we have dealt with previously and will deal with many times in the future as well. That is the seeming contradictions in Torah about the correct attitude to material possessions. On the one hand, the attitude that one has to really disregard it totally. On the other hand, the attitude that it does have certain importance in the appointment of Dayonim, for example. They have to be Ashirim. We're told they have to be people who are wealthy because of the independence that brings with it. So on the one hand, one sees the Torah gives a certain kavod to wealth. On the other hand, one is meant to not take it very seriously. We have the very difficult chazal, which we have dealt with before and which we'll deal with in a very superficial way this evening, that tzaddikim chavivim aleihem amoinam yoseh migufom, that tzaddikim value their physical possessions more than their bodies. One of the places that's learnt, you'll remember, is from Yaakov, who actually endangers himself physically to go back over the river to pick up some little odds and ends that he left there. And that also seems a little bit difficult to understand in terms of how one's meant to relate to physical possessions. That's one of the things that we'll add a bit of clarity to. The other is the old issue of the relationship between Bein Odom L'Mokim and Bein Odom L'Chaveiro, the man-God laws and the man-man laws. And the attitude that has to be developed and understood that they're inseparable. That you cannot be a mensch with the required standards of perfection of the Torah without being a ma'amin as well, without believing in the Ribbono Shel Olam and relating correctly to the man-God section of the Torah. That too should become a little clearer through the Shia tonight. I'm going to be dealing with the first Sedra. And Rashi, this is the Rashi that I mentioned to you that we have learnt before, at the end of the first Sedra summarizes the order of the whole Sedra. At the end of the Sedra we're told, again after having been told many times before, not to build idols and not to serve them and to keep Shabbos. Says Rashi, "Keneged zeh hanimkar lo'eved kochovim." If you look at the parasha contextually, you'll see that we are talking about a person who has been sold to a non-Jewish Jewish master. He's sold as a slave and his balabos is not Jewish. Shelo yomar, that he shouldn't say, Hoyil v'rabi megale arayis afanikimoiso, since my master doesn't observe any laws of sexual restraint, I too will not do so. Hoyil v'rabi oved avedas kechovim afanikimoiso, since my master serves idols, I too will do so. Hoyil v'rabi mechalo shabbos afanikimoiso, since my master is mechalo shabbos, I'll do so too. Lekach nemru mikrois halolu. Therefore these psukim are given to tell us, oh no, even if you're sold to a non-Jewish master, it has to be, the standards of Yiddishkeit have to be maintained 100%. It's a strange havamina. Who would think that that's an argument? Who would think after all the Torah is given to us, and given us so far, including the Ten Commandments themselves, Who would think that it's an argument for a man to say, because my master does it, I'm allowed to do it too? Your master's a goy. Your master's not Jewish. He doesn't have to keep these dinim. And even if he does have to keep these dinim and he doesn't, what's the one got to do with the other? There's absolutely nothing. So Shabbat doesn't apply to him at all. Gilui Arayos and Avodah Selilim does apply to him. So he doesn't do it. We know that you're not allowed to take your cue from other people, that you can't do what in your society is acceptable. We've got psukim and psukim over and over again. The land of Egypt from which I took you, you mustn't do like their deeds, and Eretz Canaan to which you're going, don't do like their deeds. What's all of a sudden the havamina that a man might say, because my master does it, I can do it too? That's the one. It's not a kasha, but one needs to understand a little bit exactly what is it that goes through this man's mind who is sold to a non-Jewish master. Then Rashi goes on and says, the afa parshiyas halolu nemru ala seder, and all these parshas in this sedra have an order to them. Bitchilo hizir ala shvis. First we're warned about the mitzvah of shmita, that every seventh year the land has to lie fallow and one has to devote that year to spiritual matters. Ve'im chomad momoin ve'nechshad ala shvis, sofer limkor metalkalov. And if a person is very attracted by money, or attracted to money, and is therefore suspected of being over shvis, of not keeping the laws of shmita, he will end up having to sell his portable property. Lekachson achlo v'chitim kiru memka, and the next parasha deals with the sale of portable property. Loi chazachozaboy, if he doesn't do tshuva, Sof moicher achuzosu, then he'll end up selling his property, his immovable property. Loi chazar boy, if he still doesn't do tshuva, sof moicher es beiso, he'll end up selling his house. Loi chazar boy, sof loi veberibis, if he still isn't over, he'll end up eventually selling, borrowing money with paying interest. Kol elu acharonis, koshis min acharonis. The latter one is always worse than the earlier one. To sell your immovable property is not as bad as to sell your movable property. To sell your movable property is not as bad as to sell your own house in which you're living. And none of them is as bad as to borrow money at current interest rates, or at any interest rate. Loi chazarbo, if he still doesn't do tshuva, sof mecher es atzmoi, he'll end up selling himself. Loi chazarbo, if he still doesn't do tshuva, loi dayo li Yisrael, not only will he land up with a Jewish master, el afilu loi vet kechovim, he might even land up with a non-Jewish master. And that's a continuation of the Rashi that we started off with. So there seems to be some indication that what Rashi is continuing with explains what he starts with, because now this man who lands up being sold to an avodas kechovim, he's the man that is warned, don't serve idols just because your master does. So we're going to have to understand a bit more of the psychology of this man. What brought him ultimately to being sold as a slave to a non-Jewish master? Follow his steps through. We won't have a chance to follow all the steps, but we'll understand the yesod of the man, what lies at the bottom of such a man, and what could bring him to such a havamina, to such an argument, to such a thought even, that because his master does all these funny things, he's permitted to do so too. There's another difficulty too, the third difficulty in the Rashi. Rashi says at the beginning, ve'im chomad momoin, and if he loves money, he's a materialistic man, ve'nechshad al hashvis, and he's therefore suspected on shvis. Notice, what's his Avera? Not Shvis. We don't know that he was over Shvis. We don't know that he didn't keep Shmita yet. His Avera, when Rashi keeps on saying, Loi Chozar, boy, he doesn't do tshuva from what? Not from having worked on the seventh year, but from being a Chomad Momen, from loving money. That's the only thing we know about him. In Chomad Momen, if he was attracted to money, and therefore he is suspected, he's the type of person who would have a tendency to work on the seventh year as well, because he loves his money so much, etc., etc. The Sipurna says at the beginning of the parasha, Sheish shonim tizro sadecho. I'll start with the previous Sipurna, it's slightly connected and it's just very beautiful and very important. Shabbos laHashem, the seventh year must be a sabbatical to Hashem. Shetihye kol hashono habetelo ma'avodas ha'adono. That whole year during which you're not working the ground, muchenes la'avodasoi, must be set aside for serving God. As was God's intention with Shabbos, with today. When we say that it's a Shabbos for God, it doesn't mean it's a day to lie and rest. It doesn't mean it's a day to take it easy. It's a day to withdraw from the world in order to devote yourself to spiritual things. And that's what the Shemitah year was, the seventh year. And he learns Pshat in the Posuk. And the land must have a sabbatical. And that sabbatical, not the land sabbatical, but your sabbatical, as a consequence of the land sabbatical, Shabbos LaHashem must be dedicated to Ribbono Shel Olam. So the laws of Shemitah are not laws of the ground. They are laws of the human being. They are laws of human behavior. They are not laws of agriculture. Then the Rosh Tikkunah goes on to say, Shei Shonim Tizra Sadecho, 6 years you will plant your field. As then, if that's what you do, that you dedicate every seventh year to the Ribbono Shel Olam, then you will find, contrary to normal agricultural practice, you will be able to plant the same field 6 consecutive years, not as is usual among agriculturists. The minag is that the land should be lie fallow 1 year and should be planted another year. There should be circulation. You don't carry on planting year after year on the same piece of ground. According to some, it's 2 years you plant and 1 year it lies fallow, but that's at least that, under normal agricultural circumstances, you would have to leave the field fallow every second year or every third year. The asafto is tvuosa, and not only will you plant the fields, but you will gather in the produce. Against the normal commercial practice, agricultural practice. Normally, if you carry on year after year planting the same field, the field will lose its strength and it won't deliver the goods. Contrary to that, if you keep the Shemitah, it will deliver the goods, even though you're going year after year. And a very simple arithmetical calculation will show you that you're using your field more by keeping the Shemitah than by not keeping the Shemitah. By keeping the Shemitah, it's only 1 in 7 years that your field is lying fallow. By not keeping Shemitah, it's every second year. It's 3 out of 6 years. It's 3.5 years every seventh year. So you're much better off financially by keeping Shemitah. So why should we say that a man who's chomer mona, that a man who loves money, is suspected about not keeping Shemitah? He'll surely see all his friends who keep Shemitah and do very well, and that they're able to plant the field year after year, and he'll learn Chumash and he'll see that there is such a thing. So if he wants to maximally utilize his field, he should keep Shemitah, he should keep the dinim. Where does Rashi know from that a man who is chomed moman, that a man who loves money, is going to have the tendency to be over on Shavis? What is a chomed moman? What is a man who loves money? What motivates him? What drives him? What is that midah of Chemdas HaMomen? The Chovas HaVovas talks about it in 2 places that I know of. Both of them in Shara Bitochen. The one place doesn't help us much. I'll read it to you because it's important to know, but it won't answer our questions. On the contrary, V'yesh mibnei odom kitos, and there are, among people there are certain categories of people, she'enom mishtadlim liknos HaMomen ulaharbos mimenu elu la'ahavas HaKovid, that what motivates them to acquire great wealth is because they love honor. Mibnei Odom. V'las is lehem shem, to make a name. V'ein maspik lohem mimenu shum dover, and they can never have enough. This is sichlus mehem, and it's nonsense. They don't understand. It's foolish. B'sibas ha-kovid b'olam hazeh v'olam habo. They don't understand what kovid really is. And the Chovas HaVovas goes on to explain that of course they're honored. But they're honored by people who would like to get a hold on their money. That's all it is. And if those people knew that there was no way of getting hold of their money, they wouldn't honor them. People don't honor rich people just because they're wonderful people. They honor rich people because they hope to get some benefit out of being close to a wealthy person. It's manipulative. They simply manipulate them, and the wealthy men fall for it, and so do the unwealthy men. And they think that one gains some kind of special social status by being wealthy. Be that as it may, the Chovas HaVovas says one of the motivations is COVID. And it's for that reason that you can never have enough, because COVID is already a spiritual thing, it's not just a physical thing. And while one can have enough of something physical and something material, you can't have enough of something which, even something which just touches the spirituality, such as COVID. And so they think that it's related. The more money you've got, the more honor you've got. And so if they've got 1 million, they need 2 million, because then they'll have twice as much honor. And if they have 3 million, they'll have 3 times as much. And so it goes on, it never ends. But that doesn't help us, as I mentioned, because here too, if it's money he's after, then the correct thing for him to do would be to keep the laws of Shemitah. He'll actually utilize the field better. If he's really clever and he looks and sees what's going on, there's no reason to ignore the laws of Shemitah in order to get wealthier. Not if he looks around at his friends. And here what I want to do with you is a little piece of the Zohar, which is very beautiful and very important. The Zohar is in Pinchas, but he's explaining a posuk in Yisra. And he explains it different to all the classical interpretations. Yitro gives Moshe some very important advice about delegating and appointing dayonim, appointing judges. And he tells Moshe what to look for in a dayan, what to look for in a judge. Ve'ato techeze mikol ha'om, and you should look among all the people. Anshei chayil, powerful people. Yirei elikim, they must be they must have yirei shemayim. Anshei emes, they must be truthful people. Sona evotza, they must despise bribery. Let's translate it simply. So Rashi interprets it one way, there's a mechilta with two interpretations. The Zohar goes a different way and he learns it not only on dayonim. And he says the following. Yisrael, the Jews, the Jewish people, be'enun midos ishtamudon, with the following characteristics they can be recognized. It's a very exciting Zohar. He's going to answer the whole question of who is a Jew. This is how you know who is Jewish. How you know the Amen Benoi the Kutshebrichu Ishkinte, how you know that these are actually the children of the Ribbono Shel Olam. These are people who follow the Ribbono Shel Olam, who act as children of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and who are children of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Lemevi Beloin, there must be in them Anshei Chayil. There must be the Midah of Anshei Chayil, this characteristic that Yisrael calls Anshei Chayil. Kigoin Eishes Chayil Ateres Bailo, like the concept of an Eishes Chayil, Mare de Chesed. That's somebody who's able to master chesed. That's what Anshei Chayil means. Somebody who's potent in his chesed. Somebody who's able to do, who's able to be effective in chesed. Furthermore, he must be Yorei Eloki, the second characteristic which Yisro demanded. And that is, they must have Yirei Shamayim. One can give a shir, obviously, and many shirim on each one of these, and sometime we will and have done, and it's really the last one that I'm interested in. Anshei emes v'loy anshei sheker, they must be truthful people and not people who are not truthful. It's interesting the way the Zohar puts it. It doesn't just say anshei emes v'loy anshei sheker, which seems to imply that just saying anshei emes wouldn't be enough, that the borderline is so defined to such a tiny degree. Anshei emes v'loy anshei sheker, must be truth and no dishonesty. D'bnei Yisrael lo yasu avlo, the Jewish people should not do anything crooked. V'lo yedabru kozov, and they shouldn't talk dishonestly. V'lo yimtza b'fiin loshon tarmis, and there must never be found in their mouths anything which is cunning, a word which is cunning. And if one does find these midas, the Jewishness is absent. And the last one, v'sonei betza, and they must despise bribery, as we translated. Kebar nash someach b'chelke. And the Zohar defines Sonei Betza not as hating bribery, but as a man who enjoys what he's got, Hasameach Bechelko, is happy with what he's got. V'loy ke'erev Rav b'noy d'shivcha bisho, and not like the Erev Rav, like those people who were introduced to Klal Yisrael when they left Egypt, but they weren't Jews by nature. The inim kechivya, they are like the snake. Let's just stop there a moment before we go, and you know what the image of the snake is. That's the Yetzer Hara. Right from the beginning of the Chumash, the Yetzer Hara is introduced to us in the image of the snake. So when he talks about the Inun Kechivya, that they are like the snake, he's talking about the very essence of the Yetzer Hara. What is the Yetzer Hara? What's the nature of the snake? The whole Aro Kadme, the whole land is in front of him. That's what it means when it says in the Pasuk that a snake eats dust. In a sense, he's very lucky, one would think. He doesn't have to go looking for his food anywhere. Wherever he goes, there he's got food. He's able to eat. His food is readily available. And in infinite quantities. That's what the Zohar says. The whole Arad Kadmeh, the whole world is in front of the snake. He doesn't have to worry about his panosa for one moment. His living is all cut out for him, and he's a millionaire before he starts. A billionaire. Whatever he wants in the world in terms of food, he's got. The dachil misbo miafra, and he's unable. He withholds himself from satisfying himself from the dust. He never fills himself. When he eats, he eats a little bit. He doesn't eat to his satisfaction. Why? Such a tzaddik? Do you think the snake is such a tzaddik that he doesn't want to fill his stomach? He's not a glutton. No, says the Zohar, no fear of that. The dachil the techsale is afraid there won't be anything tomorrow. That's weird. It doesn't make any sense. The whole essence of the snake, in terms of the curse he was given, was this kind of strange curse, which in a sense seems to be a little bit of a blessing, that his food is limitlessly available, and of all the briyas, of all the creations, he's the one who doesn't fill his stomach so as to leave something for tomorrow. Just make sure that there's something left over for tomorrow. Bahachi mare betza, and that's what the people of bribery are. The lois vein mikol momoin da alma. They are not satisfied with all the money in the world. That's the midah. We need to understand this very well and very carefully. There's several yesodos here. There's several very fundamental principles. The first one is that the Zohar has defined the very essence of that which we call the Yetzirah. We literally speak about the Yetzirah this and the Yetzirah that. The Yetzirah is that drive in the human being, that middle in the human being, that emotion in the human being, that characteristic in the human being, which causes his downfall every time. When you do something and you afterwards you feel let down, you didn't really want to do that. That's not the way you would have wanted it. The Yetzirah did it. There's something inside each one of us, some kind of drive, some kind of motivation, which is destructive. And which keeps on getting the better of us. We have to constantly work at keeping it in check. If we leave it alone for a moment, all of a sudden it breaks out and again it pulls us down to levels that we didn't plan to fall. This Yetzirah, what is it? And you'll find all different stories about what the Yetzirah is and what the Yetzirah is. Here we have a definition of what the Yetzirah is. This Yetzirah is the snake who has limitless sources of income, and those limitless sources are not enough for him. He's always leaving for tomorrow. That means that the chomed momon, the person who loves money, it's not so much that he loves money. That's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about a man who's worried that he'll have nothing for tomorrow. Slightly different. What is the difference? Really, it comes out the opposite. And maybe that's why the word chomed momon is used rather than ohev momon, a person who loves money. Because the chomed momon, the person who we're talking about here, this nachash, this snake in us, doesn't really love money at all. If he really loved and valued money, the value of the money which he doesn't have would be so enormous that it would be sufficient for him. And he would, at worst, if he's really got a big tithe, if he's really got a big desire, at worst he would want all the money in the world. But here the Zohar tells us that all the money in the world won't even satisfy him. That really means he devalues money. That really means he thinks money is worth less than it really is. Because it's weird to think that a person would not be satisfied with all the money in the world, with all the wealth that there is in the world, he wouldn't be satisfied. That means all the wealth in the world is not worth very much to him. And he's still worried that he won't have enough for tomorrow. There's something really cockeyed about such a man. There's something really has gone wrong with him. On the other hand, if one is a chomed momon, if one really does love money, then one should look at it the other way around, and one should say, look, there is a... I don't know what, $1,000 billion of wealth in the world, of which I have $50. That's what I have. But I think that money is so fantastic that my $50 is worth $10 million to me. So what does the other $5 billion mean? Really, if one loves them, if one values it correctly, or if one overvalues it, the tendency would rather be to be satisfied with what you've got, rather than to want more. It's because of the devaluation that what I've got is worth nothing and I need more, and as much as I get is also worth nothing and I need more. It's a feeling of the worthlessness of money that causes him to desire it and to crave with an appetite which is insatiable. And perhaps that's a little bit of an understanding to that chazal which I mentioned to you, that tzaddikim, that says that they love their money, mamoinon. They don't love other people's money. Yosei migufam. They value their own money. We discussed it once, why and what goes into a tzaddik's earning of his money and how, why he values it so much. But be that as it may, the fact is, he values his own money. What does that mean when he values his own money? He doesn't want any more. What he's got is sufficient. Valuing money doesn't mean you value other people's money or you value the acquisition of money. That's why it's, they love their own money. They love their own physical possessions and material possessions and value what they have got over and above what the rest of the world has got put together. My own little thing that I've got and it's mine is worth more to me than what everybody else has got put together. And that enables them to change their whole relationship to money altogether. We'll come back to that in a moment. Based on this, there's the second Chovas Avovas, which I'll show you, which now makes a lot of sense. Habeteach be'elokim, when a person trusts in God, k'sheyivoso lo dovar al mezoino, what does he do when he's earned more than he needs? He'll spend it on what the Ribbono Shel'olam requires him to spend it. With a generosity of spirit and a goodness of heart. There'll be no feeling of if he gives some money to a poor person or he gives it to support Torah, there'll be no feeling that I'm giving my money, that what right has he got to me. Not only will he give, but he'll give with nedivus, with generosity and openness and a good heart. Because he's got what he needs already. He doesn't need any more. He'll understand that everything comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam in any case, and what he's got, and the rest he can use. And somebody who doesn't trust in God, he doesn't see the whole world and everything that's in it as satisfying his desires for parnosah, for earning a living. That's something one needs to recognize in oneself, at least. That it's not just, I just want another little bit, and if I've got another little bit, I can buy a television, and if I've got a little bit more than that, I can buy a motor car too, and if I've got more than that, I can buy two motor cars. It's not that at all. There is just no limit, whatever, it doesn't stop. If one has this midah of not being sameach b'chelko, as the Zohar puts it, if one has this midah of loving money, not one's own, but the rest of it, you could have everything in the whole world, and you still wouldn't be satisfied. And he has pity for his money. He develops an emotional relationship with his money, and he can't part with it too easily. He loves it, and that causes him mihashlim chayvas haboyre v'chayvas bnei odom. He's unable to fulfill his duties to the Ribbono Shel Olam, nor his duties to mankind. He doesn't pay his accounts on time. Pretty strange. I'm sure anybody who's in business has found that it's not the poor people who don't pay their accounts on time. It's the wealthy people who don't pay their accounts on time. It's the bigger companies that don't pay their accounts on time. What is it? It's a chaymed moment, so another 100 rand, another 50 rand. What difference does it make? All the money in the world makes a difference. To lose interest for 1 month on 50 rand makes a difference. Makes a difference to a big company, not to a little man. A little man who's got what he needs and he's got what he wants, it makes no difference at all. What does he need? The money doesn't belong to him in any case. I might as well pay it over. So it's the chovas haboreh, the chovas b'yodim. One's debts to the Ribbono Shel Olam become neglected because one just can't part with the stuff. And one's debts to Bnei Adam, to people, become neglected as a result of this. The Einoi Margish Boy, and he loses sensitivity to it eventually, Ad Sheyaved Mimenu Mamoin, until eventually he loses his money other ways. The Yeshua Zulosa, and eventually he lands up without it. Kemo Shekosov Achochem, Shlomo HaMelech says in Mishle, Yesh Mefazer V'Noisaf Oid, there are some people who spend money, and the more they spend somehow, the more they get. V'Choisech Miyosher Achle Machzer, and there are some people who save money in situations where they should do what's right, and instead there they become, all of a sudden they're saving. And achla machsa, the more they save, the less they've got. So here we see, firstly, a reflection in, this is really halacha, this is really, the chovas havovos is not just a musa sefer, the chovas havovos is practical halacha, things that one has to do. One sees the principle of the Zohar expressed in the chovas havovos, that it's not just a question of quantity and how much and degree. It's two kinds of human beings. You've got the one who will never have enough, and all the money in the world is not of sufficient value to him, and you have the other where whatever he needs, that's what defines his needs. And over and above that, he uses for good purpose. But there's an additional yesod here in the Chovas Avodos, which is the most important of all. And that is his definition of these two categories. The one is the Boteach Be'elokim, and the one is the one who's not Boteach Be'elokim, the one who trusts in God and the one who doesn't. And let's stop there a moment. So the yesod that we had in the Zohar, the foundation that we had in the Zohar, was that the essence of the Yetzer Hora, this which causes people to do wrong in all areas, the Yetzer Hora is now responsible for all wrongdoing, interpersonal, man, God, the lot. The essence of it is this Eino Sameach B'Chelko, he's not satisfied with what he's got. The Chovas Avov is telling us that because of that is a lack of bitochen, a lack of trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Let's just define it a little bit more clearly, and then we'll have the whole thing pretty well worked out. What is it in the man that is not Sameach b'chelko? We said it's his fear that tomorrow there won't be. That's the essence of it. It's an amazing thing when you'll stop to think of it. And I must tell you that a Zohar like this takes one a few weeks of turning over in your mind to suddenly realize what it is that he's saying. That the Ahavas Kesef, or the Chendas Momen, is not the love for the money, but the fear that there won't be anything tomorrow. It's a sickness. It's a sickness of insecurity. That means no matter how wealthy you are, you can be as wealthy as the snake, where you have limitless panasa. Irrespective of the degree of your wealth, a man who has the Yetzirah working strongly inside him is afflicted by this terrible fear of tomorrow, that there might not be enough for tomorrow. That's his fear. That doesn't mean that one doesn't have to plan for the future. That doesn't mean that one mustn't take out an insurance policy. We're not talking about that. One plans for the future and one does what one can, but one doesn't have sleepless nights about the future. People should, by reading old newspapers or a little bit of history, or asking their parents or grandparents, should realize how little planning for the future has really helped in the past, and how the future looks very different from what it was anticipated to look previously. And as much as that applied in previous generations, I'm sorry or happy to say it's going to apply infinitely more in our generation and in future generations. The rate of change is just such that it's not possible to know what things are going to look like, never mind in 50 years' time, but even in 20 years' time, or in 10 years' time, or 5 years' time, or for tomorrow also, is not that easy to know what it's going to look like. Who knows what you're going to read in the newspaper when you open it tomorrow? It's just not possible to know. Imagine, I think I've mentioned to you once, a couple of months ago, if one said, England and Argentina will be at war. You'd have laughed, ridiculous. England and Argentina at war? It happens, and it happens quickly, and one doesn't even notice it. All of a sudden, there it is. So while one can plan for the future to the best of one's ability, one doesn't have this fear, one doesn't have this preoccupation of, oi, what will be tomorrow? How will I manage? What will there be tomorrow? That not. What is it? A man who has that fear for tomorrow is a man, A, who thinks that God is going to, chas v'sholem, disappear tonight. This is the last day of God's existence on the world. He looks after me today, but tomorrow who knows what will be? Why, who knows what will be? If I live today, and I would manage today, and I had parnasa today, I had a living today, and I was able to eat today, why should tomorrow be different? God's not going to look after anybody anymore from tonight. That not. And it's a feeling, if one really had the feeling of emunah, if one really believed that today was good because I had somebody looking after me, one wouldn't worry about tomorrow. The reason we worry about tomorrow is because we don't feel that today was good because somebody was looking after me. Today we think was good because we had good luck, or because we were very clever. And who knows if we're going to be as clever tomorrow, we're going to have as good luck tomorrow. God just disappears from the picture. The Ribbono Shel Olam is out. If one would feel that relationship with Him now in the present, one's fears of the future would be very much eased. It's like the little child who suffers from insecurity. You hold the child's hand, the insecurity goes. Why doesn't the child sit and carry on crying, worrying about what will happen when his daddy leaves his hand alone? He doesn't. As long as his daddy is holding his hand, he's happy completely. About the future as well, he feels satisfied. Security is a result, is the consequence of trust. To feel present trust, to feel a trust at the moment one feels, and certainly a trust when one's talking about a trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam. The trust is it's a midah, it's an experience, it's bitochen, which doesn't disappear. And it's not something which causes one or allows one to feel insecure even about tomorrow. Eric Fromm in fact mentioned that wealth is not having money, it's spending money. It's what you can do, it's what you can affect, it's the feeling you can have, it's the achievement you can reach. Taking it further than he did, it's the mitzvahs you can do with your money that gives you that sense of wealth, that sense of financial potency that we call wealth. To have it locked up in such a way that you can't use it, and all it's doing is suffering the ravages of inflation, that's not called wealth. So you've got a quantitative thing, but you're not a different person as a result of it. And we're talking here about a different person. We're talking about a person who's sameach b'chelko, a person who's able to utilize what he's got. He's able to adjust what he needs in terms of what he's got, and he's able to enjoy what he's got. That's what he needs. He doesn't need more than he's got. And here we come in fact to the essence of the belief. If the human being believes in a God, and he believes in a God that is watching, and he believes in a God that knows what he's doing, he must believe, this is the very first step of belief, that whatever I need to do what he wants from me, he'll give me. And it would be crazy to think that a person comes to work for you, a domestic comes into your house to work for you, and wants to start sweeping the floor, and you say, sorry, there's no broom. And she wants to cook the meal, and you say, sorry, there's no stove. But cook, go on, that's what I've employed you for, to cook. It's weird, that can't be. whatever it is that the Ribbono Shel Olam wants from us, that you can know. He's given you the kelim, he's given you the tools that you need to do it. So what are your needs? Your needs are that which he has given you. You don't need anything which he hasn't given you. That's the first level of the belief. And when that starts existing, the beautiful passages of the Chovetz Chavos here, which we'll do sometime, once that exists, a whole new peace and tranquility descends upon the person. All of a sudden, life is pleasant. His ambitions can be directed to important areas. He's able to enjoy life a little bit more. He's able to take pleasure in what he's got without being consumed with a desire for what he hasn't got. Because he understands with perfect clarity that what he's got is what he needs in order to fulfill his function. If the root of all the evil is this inability to be sameach b'chelko, this inability to be satisfied with what you've got, that means the root of all the evil, it's wrong to say that the root of all the evil is money. Because we did mention that anshei chayil, the judges that are chosen, Rashi says, are ashirim, they must be wealthy. And if money was evil, then you wouldn't have great wealthy people, they would have to throw their money out. So money is not evil. But in the Rashi a little bit further on, when Rashi learns Sein Ebetza, and he learns it different to the Zohar, he learns it like the Mechilta, when Rashi learns Sein Ebetza, he basically learns, people, I'll read to show you the Rashi inside. Shesoinim es mamoinam bedin. While they're busy judging, while they've got two litigants in front of them, they hate their money, their own money. That means that while they're able to relate positively to what they've got, they're able to turn off from it as well. It's not that important. When they're busy paskining, when they're busy judging, their money just is unimportant. So what we're really saying is not that money is the root of all evil, but the inability to relate correctly to money is the source of all evil. And it goes a step deeper than that. It's the inability to be satisfied with what you've got. And let's just look at it and we'll see. What is it that drives a person to be dishonest? Say in a business sense. What is it that drives a person to drive a deal which he knows is not really honest? The whole Sedra today talks about not buying something for less than it's worth, when the seller doesn't know what he's doing, and not selling something for more than it's worth when the buyer doesn't know what he's doing. The Isurim of Oino, of deceiving a buyer or a seller in terms of the value of the goods. What drives a man to do that? So he might be, and again one finds, you know, dishonesty isn't always with a little corner cafe who's selling something for 5 cents and he charges you 6 cents. That's not usually where you'll find the dishonesty. You'll usually find it on a big deal. That there's 50 rand where it shouldn't be, or 100 rand where it shouldn't be, a very small percentage of the whole thing, sometimes bigger amounts. But what drives a man, a big amount or a smaller amount? The need for money. Okay, but you're doing a deal, you're making a sale, you're making a profit, you're making as much profit as you expected to make, but you want a little bit more. Why? And who knows what will be tomorrow? I'm making a sale today, but what will be tomorrow? If a person knew for absolute sure that tomorrow would be as good as today or even better, the pressure to be dishonest would be a little bit less. So the dishonesty in business dealing, the dishonesty just in talking, in conversation. What drives one to say something which isn't quite true? Because you want to make an impression, you want to be thought of better than you really are thought of. Why is it needed? Why is it necessary? It's that same insecurity. Who knows what people will say and what people will think. And so one finds it in every walk of life and in everything that one's involved in. This fear that what I've got is not good enough. They must think better of me than I am. They must pay me more than it's really worth. If I'm buying, I must buy it for less than it's really worth. I must get something which is worth more than the money I'm paying over. Just moving away from that which is accurate and honest, that which is absolutely true and absolutely accurately measured. Why? Because what is not good enough. Its true value is not good enough for me. My true value is not good enough for me. Why? An insecurity. And as a result of that comes the dishonesty, comes the stealing, comes the theft, comes the degeneracy, comes the stealing not only of physical and material possessions, comes the stealing of affections, comes the stealing of loyalties, comes the absence of loyalties, all developed by a feeling of, oh, who knows what will be tomorrow, who knows what will be tomorrow, I must batter my bread on both sides just in case. And so you develop a whole attitude among people which we've talked about previously, where nobody's prepared to stand up for anything. Because you know you've got to be careful who you back. Maybe tomorrow you don't know who will be the powerful one. So I better rather keep quiet, not get involved in the argument, not take sides. Why? A fear tomorrow, who knows what will be. The fact that there's a Ribbono Shel Olam who stands behind those people who do what is right and that which is true, that you forget about. That doesn't come into it at all. Lastly, I'm going to now do a Vilna Gaon, which I've done with you before. Then we'll look back in the Rashi and you'll see it all fitting together very nicely. By the way, this lesson was taught to Klal Yisrael the very first time that as a nation they became involved in earning a living, which was with Ammon. I would tell, don't try and go and get more than you've been told to get. It won't help you at all. And those who did go out and collect a little bit more, it didn't last, it didn't keep. What the Ribbono Shel Olam has decided is yours, that's what you've got. And you must learn to adjust your desires to what you've got, not your ambitions to your desires. You've got to learn to take pleasure in what is yours, not to want that which is not yours. On the pasuk at the end of the 13th chapter of Mishlei, Tzadik oichel l'soiva nafsho yivetzen v'shoim techsov, that a tzadik eats to satisfaction, and the stomach of a rosho is always empty, which is the opposite to what people think. The old question is always, how come that all the righteous people are poor, and all the wicked people have it so easy? And until one starts going into the lives of the righteous people and the wicked people, one doesn't realize what a superficial observation has caused that question. Because as we see from the snake, having it all doesn't mean that you're satisfied. Having it all doesn't mean that you're happy and that you're enjoying it and that you're relating to it correctly. Having it all is that you have the possibility for great enjoyment, but that's all. And here we see exactly the opposite, that a tzaddik eats to satisfaction and he always feels satisfied, and the rishayim always feel hungry. He says the Vilna Gaon, no matter how much they've got. Tzaddik oichel l'soiva nafsho ki atzaddik be'emunoso yichye. Here we have the Vilna Gaon defining exactly what we've just said. Why is it that a tzaddik is always satisfied? Because of his emunah. It's because of his belief in God that he's able to develop that satisfaction. Uvoteach ba'Hashem, and he trusts in God. V'lachin lo yariv es nafsho. And so he doesn't, if he's got something to eat, he comes Shabbos, he eats it. He doesn't worry about what will be for next Shabbos. So even a poor tzaddik, what he's got, he sits down and he enjoys, and he has it, and he knows that where that came from, there's more. Again, that doesn't mean, chas v'sholem, that one has to be... go completely overboard and spend every penny that one's got and eat every piece of food in the house, because if one doesn't, one's not showing trust in God. It's not like that at all. What it means is that what you eat, what you need, what you have, you enjoy without being obsessed by a fear that consuming something today means it's gone. That's really what it is. The materialistic obsession today is the fear that what I spend today is gone, what I eat today is gone, I won't get it back, what I give to charity today is gone. That feeling one has to get rid of, and one gets it rid of it through emunah. Uvetin reshoim techsar, and the stomach of the reshoim is empty. Shehin misyarin shema lo yeh lo emochel lecho, because they are worried that tomorrow they'll have nothing to eat. Kichol ma'ashiyesh lo em huma'at etzlam, because whatever they've got is little. Ve'im lo em bitochin ba'ashem, and they don't trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Umekamtzim achiloson, and they are miserly in what they eat and spend. Ve'lachin bitnom choser, so they're always feeling empty. They've never got enough. And then he goes on to say, V'chein b'toira, the same applies in Torah. Tzadik oichel l'soiva, a tzadik eats with satisfaction, sheloimed b'chdei sheyehei soveya. When a tzadik learns, he learns in order to satisfy himself, in order to feel the spiritual satisfaction of understanding truth. V'ein eroye im ma'at v'im harbe, he's not looking at as he covered a little, as he covered a lot. Rak sheyehei yodea al borya. The first thing that's important is that he knows it with clarity. Obviously, when you know something with clarity, it's nice to learn some more and to go on. We're not talking about having no desire to do anymore, to learn anymore. But one's basic drive is not for more, but for better. To understand it clearly and then to go further. The yis by nafsho, and he'll satisfy his soul. The yikayim. Ach betin reshoim techsa. Sorry, the yekayim achbetin reshoim techsar, and how will the other side of the phrase, the converse side of the phrase, that the stomach of the reshoim is always empty, how will that be fulfilled? Ki ein kavanosam rak lizgadel beine abriyus. A rosho is learning Torah, believe it or not, you can find them in the Beis Medrash as well. Don't think that the reshoim are only on the stock exchange. You might find tzadikim on the stock exchange, and you might find reshoim in the Beis Medrash that are learning. One has to look very careful to discriminate and to discern who's the tzadik and who's the rosho. Because here we're talking about a rosho Who's there? He's learning. But why is he learning? He's gadol b'enei abriyus, to acquire stature in the eyes of society. The kovtin harbe b'fanachas, and he wants to learn a lot quickly. He can't integrate so much so quickly. It's not possible for him to really understand and to integrate and to swallow what he's doing. And as a result of that, their stomachs will be empty. They will lack the spiritual satisfaction of learning. There you've got the Vilna Gaon basically explaining in very much fewer words exactly what we've said. That this material satisfaction, the capacity for material satisfaction, is a function of emuna and bitochen. It's a function of belief and of trust in God, and the lack of that capacity is a lack of trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that it finds itself not only in the material area but in all areas. When one talks about quantity versus quality, it makes no difference whether the quantity is a quantity of money, or it's a quantity of motor cars, or it's a quantity of ships, or a quantity of companies, or quantity of pages. That's Betin Rishoyim Tetzla. One's never going to have the satisfaction of really enjoying in a spiritual way that which one is learning. One can learn one little Rashi and understand it clearly and nicely, or one Medrash, one Mishnah, a few lines of Gemara, and really understand it properly, and you feel good at the end. And you can learn 10 daf and you have a confused idea of what it's all about, and you certainly don't understand the basic principles of it, and you go out without that spiritual satisfaction. What we developed a little bit further that isn't covered in this Vilna Gaon is the fact that that's the source of all evil. The Vilna Gaon is talking about something specific, and that is the lack of capacity for satisfaction. But we've taken it further on the basis of the Zohar that lack of capacity for satisfaction is in itself the Yetzer Hara. It's that which drives one to do the crazy things that people do to try and make up for that lack of satisfaction, for that lack of capacity. If we now look at Rashi, we'll see that it fits in very beautifully. Let's start at the end. So, in Chomad Momen, Nechshad al Ashvis, his Aveira is Chemdas HaMomen. That's what we're talking about. We're talking a man whose Aveira is not that he just was over Shvis. That's one Aveira. It's a serious Aveira, but it's one. We're talking about a man who's Chomad Momen, a man who loves money, and in terms of the Zohar that we learnt, that means that he loves money to such an extent that all the money in the world is not of any value to him, it's not sufficient to him. Such a man we're talking about who is inherently degenerate and corrupt. He has nothing. With that, he's kuli Yetzer Hara. The whole man is a Yetzer Hara. Everything he does is for a desire for more of something which he can't have and which will never satisfy him. That's who we're dealing with. The worst of the worst that they can be. So obviously he's going to be Nechshad al Ashvis. Why? Because it's not the quantity of money he's after. The quantity won't help him. He can't bring himself not to plant the field on the seventh year. What will be tomorrow? That's what he can't do. It's true we've done very well the 6 years. And it's unnatural how well we've done. Normally you've got to leave a field. But he would rather leave a field. He would rather have less money, but know that he'll have tomorrow as well. That's the essence of the Rosh. So he would rather circulate his fields and work one every second year and make sure that every year there's something coming in. Because he doesn't believe it comes from God. He believes it comes from the field. So at least this way he knows, tomorrow there'll be as well. So when we're talking about a chomed moment, we're not necessarily talking about a person who goes out to acquire more money and his only drive is to want more money. We're going after a person who can't believe that where today's money came from will come tomorrow as well. The person is lacking that basic trust, is lacking that basic emunah. And so he would rather rotate his fields in a way where he gets half the yield, then work with a Shemitah where he only loses 1 year's production, but that year there's nothing. That he won't do because he doesn't believe he can have the blessing, that he can have the bracha which he requires. Now one understands why such a man is in danger when he starts serving a non-Jewish master. And also we have to realize that this threat of serving a non-Jewish master is a threat in which many of us, or most of us, find ourselves most of the time. If not in the sense of avdus, it's not in the sense of actually having been sold, employers, working for people who don't keep the values that we keep, living in a society that don't keep to the things that we keep. We're all faced with that same danger, and the only way we can save ourselves from this last fear, that is, that it can bring one even to not keeping Shabbos and to serving idolatry in its various forms and to not keeping a standard of morality which the Torah requires of us. Why? The man is insecure. That's his basic problem. We've talked about the essence of corruption is, one's going to summarize the shir into one phrase, we're going to say the essence of degeneracy is insecurity. To feel insecure is what causes all the troubles. So this is a man who feels insecure, and that in fact brought him to work on the Shemitah year. And furthermore, that didn't solve his insecurity. And as his wealth decreased, he had to sell his material possessions. First his movable ones, then his even immovable ones, then his house. Finally he had to sell himself, he had to become a slave. And now the ultimate, he had to sell himself to a non-Jewish master. He's now a slave working for a non-Jewish master. Now what's left? If he still feels insecure, what now? And he will still feel insecure, because insecurity is not solved by external factors. Insecurity is a factor of lack of trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam. So he's got to the very bottom now. He's now working as a slave for a non-Jewish master, and he still feels insecure. Now all he can do is ingratiate himself. Now maybe if he gets on the right side of his master, he'll be a little bit better off. So all he can end up doing now is doing that which his master values. He doesn't value anything anymore. All he wants is security. And his only hope of security is his master. And that's why it's difficult sometimes to put oneself into those situations, but to understand, A, that which was behind those Jewish people in concentration camps who did cooperate with the Nazis. And the knowledge that I'm told on good authority that there wasn't one religious person who did it. That there wasn't one Rav, and there wasn't one yeshiva person, there wasn't one Ben Torah throughout all the history of the concentration camps that even had the tendency to cooperate in the slightest way, whereas there were many, many others. The pressures to do it, one can understand, the pressures are enormous, your life is in danger. The only chance of being able to possibly get out alive, or even if one doesn't know about getting out alive, at least to live another day, is to cooperate a little bit, not actively, just a little bit, give them a bit of information, help them out here, ingratiate oneself a little bit here and there. And it became more than that. It came to the point of active participation in the torture and in the destruction. It wasn't just in the concentration camps. There was such a concept in Egypt as well, in Mitzrayim as well. One can understand this, and I've often asked myself, what is it, what resources does a human being need to withstand that kind of temptation? To say, take me, kill me, do what you want, I won't cooperate, I won't, nothing, I won't touch a fellow Jew. And no way will I harm him or endanger his life, whatever. What is it that one needs when one's starving? When one has a child who's starving? And just by a little bit of ingratiation, you can get a piece of bread which you know will get the child at least till tomorrow. And a parent's feeling for a little baby that's on the verge of starvation, what do you need inside you to make sure that even that doesn't get you over? It's emuna and bitochen, a feeling of security. I live today. If that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants, I'll live tomorrow. Whatever he wants from me, whatever he wants from my baby, whatever he wants from my family, he's given us the kelim to do. There's no question that if he needs us alive, he'll keep us alive. And unless one has that, one's in danger of losing one's humanity, not just losing one's morality. Because when we're talking about that level, we're not talking about morality. We're talking about doing things which are inhuman. And one faces the risk of losing one's humanity. When one looks at it in this extreme way, and it's not as extreme as it sounds, because we're faced with these situations every day, whereby just doing something which is not the kind of thing we would do if we were our own bosses, but because of circumstances, it might be a little bit better after all to do it this way. When one looks at it in that situation, under those circumstances, one understands that the pressures on one to be immoral are so great that the only way of withstanding it is to have such inner security that there is just no fear about tomorrow, whatever, no obsession about tomorrow, no worry about tomorrow, not no care about tomorrow. One does care, but one doesn't have this fear and one doesn't have that obsession. And the only derech to that, as the Chovetz Chaim said and as the Zohar said, is through the bitochen, through that understanding of the trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam and that relationship with God, which is the essence of the first five commandments, the first tablets, which leads one into being able to successfully live and practice the second commandments, which cover the relationship between man and man.